Life in prison or even the death penalty is a very debatable sentence even for an adult. But shooting a child in a trial, you might think, isn't too harsh or inhumane for a child. However, these kids aren't your typical kids who steal random things or lie to get out of school. So I stabbed him there first. I've done it a few times, and as I did it, my voices were laughing. The actions of these boys could be taken from a horror movie, and their lack of remorse is even more chilling. This hand that pulled the trigger that killed his children is now masturbating to the memory. You all. Possessed by demons, corrupted by evil, or just plain psychopaths. These kids will make you think twice before shedding a tear for them. Seandl Jackson. In a Milwaukee courtroom, a scene of utter chaos unfolded as sheriff's deputies were forced to subdue Seandl Jackson, a 19-year-old convicted murderer, following a life sentence verdict. The air was thick with tension and the sharp sting of pepper spray as the young man's reaction to the judge's sentence turned violent. This was no ordinary sentence. It was the culmination of a tragic story that began with the cold-blooded murder of Nathan Potter, a promising film student whose life was cut short in a senseless robbery attempt. The young man, just 19, was accused of a crime that had shaken the community to its core. The murder of Nathan Potter, a 21-year-old film student at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, whose aspirations were brutally cut short one fateful night in July. As the Potter family entered the courtroom, their faces etched with the pain of their loss, a palpable sense of grief engulfed the space. The prosecution had presented a case that was as compelling as it was heartbreaking, detailing how Jackson, along with his accomplice Derek Jett Thomas, had attempted to rob Nathan Potter as he was walking home. As night fell, the two young men hatched a plan that was as desperate as it was dangerous. They needed money, and they were prepared to get it by force. Armed with a .45 caliber pistol, they set their sights on a local tavern on Deuceman Street, a place where patrons were likely to have cash. With no money to offer, Potter was shot in the chest, his life snuffed out by nothing more than cruel intent and a botched robbery. They retreated to Thomas's home, where they attempted to drown the gravity of their actions in the virtual world of video games, a stark contrast to the real-life violence they had just inflicted. As Judge Rebecca Dillette prepared to pronounce sentence, Jackson's attorney, Patrick Earl, made a final effort to appeal to the judge's sense of mercy, citing Jackson's youth and lack of impulse control. However, the gravity of the crime overshadowed these pleas. The courtroom erupted as the sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole was handed down. Jackson's response was immediate and explosive. He spewed a stream of obscenities at Judge Dillette, and it took the swift intervention of three sheriff's deputies and Detective James Hutchinson to drag Jackson to the ground. The courtroom erupted into confusion, and pepper spray was deployed to control the situation. The Potter family, witnessing this explosive reaction, clung even tighter to each other, their tears a silent testament to their grief. In stark contrast, Jackson's family members unleashed their own fury, adding fuel to the fire with their taunts. Shouts of "Osodio" and "God's the judge" were hurled at them, heightening the already palpable tension. The sentencing had become more than just a courtroom proceeding. It was a stark display of the emotional turmoil that such a heinous crime had wrought on all involved. TJ Lane, a young high school murderer, entered the courtroom for his trial. From the moment he entered the room, however, it was abundantly clear that he was unrepentant. TJ Lane wore a white t-shirt with the word "murderer" scrawled across it in bold, defiant script. This brazen attire was no mere fashion statement, it was a calculated affront, a visual testament to the horror he had inflicted. Born into a family where turmoil was not uncommon, TJ's early life was marked by instability and conflict. His father, Thomas Lane Jr., was a shadowy figure for his incarceration and violence, particularly against women, including TJ's own mother. This cycle of domestic turmoil led to TJ and his siblings being removed from their parents' custody. A disturbing start to what should have been an innocent childhood. TJ found some stability with his grandparents who became his guardians. However, Echoes of his fractured home life seem to follow him into the halls of Chardon High School. Described by his classmates as reserved, TJ was a solitary figure adrift on the periphery of teenage social circles. He did not favor divulging the details of his tumultuous home life, nor did he find solace in the camaraderie of clubs or sports teams. The victims' families, already dealing with immeasurable loss, recoiled from the image. Their anguish was palpable, and the killer's utter disrespect compounded their pain. The courtroom sanctuary of justice became a theater of psychological warfare as Lane's actions dealt blow after blow to the already fractured spirits of those in attendance. When TJ Lane entered Lake Academy Alternative School, his behavior began to cast unsettling shadows that hinted at the turmoil within. Once a gentle child, remembered for his calm demeanor, he began to show signs of deeper distress. A disturbing message surfaced on social media, a somber foreboding written by TJ himself. The words were stark, an ominous prelude that read, "I am death and you have always been the grass. Now feel death, not just taunting you, not just stalking you, but inside you." This alarming message, shared 2 months before the shooting, marked a chilling departure from the TJ Lane his peers knew. The warning went unheeded, a cry lost in the digital void. Those who knew him struggled to reconcile the image of the withdrawn teen with the heartbreaking personality that emerged from his online footprint. On September 27, 2012, at approximately 7:30 a.m., Lane stormed the Chardon High School cafeteria, armed with a handgun. He knew that many students would be gathered in the cafeteria before classes began and opened fire on them. He shot and killed 5 male and 1 female students before fleeing the cafeteria. By the time his rampage was over, he had killed 3 students and seriously injured 2. Lane's demeanor escalated as the sentencing hearing unfolded. In a moment that would go down in the depths of courtroom infamy, he turned to face the families of the slain students. With chilling nonchalance, he uttered words so vile, so profane, that they seemed to echo endlessly off the walls of the courtroom. His voice, laced with contempt, proclaimed, "This hand that pulled the trigger that killed your children, now masturbates to the memory. FCK you all." The courtroom recoiled in horror. The raw vulgarity of his statement left a stain on the solemn proceedings. From afar, the audience strained to comprehend the scene unfolding before them. The headline-filled media painted a portrait of a young man whose actions seemed to transcend the bounds of human decency. Lane's behavior, dress, and words became the subject of heated discussion, a disturbing spectacle that defied social norms. Faced with such provocation, the judge unflinchingly handed down the sentence. Lane was sentenced to 3 life terms, one for each of the lives he had callously taken. There would be no parole, no deferral of justice. Brenda Spencer, "I don't like Mondays." That was the startling and shocking statement Brenda Spencer made after she went on a shooting rampage at her school on a chilling January morning in 1979 in a suburban neighborhood of San Diego, California. A year before the infamous shooting, Brenda's troubling behavior escalated when she was arrested for shooting out windows at Cleveland Elementary School with a BB gun. While no one was injured, the incident was an ominous harbinger of things to come. Despite this, the juvenile justice system issued a probationary sentence, a decision that would later come under scrutiny. In the months that followed, Brenda's probation officer recognized signs of depression and recommended psychiatric treatment. However, Wallace Spencer rejected this advice, stating that he could manage his daughter's mental health issues on his own. An avid gun collector, Wallace unwittingly fostered a similar interest in Brenda. Later, his fascination with firearms would grow into more than a hobby. In a decision that would have catastrophic consequences, he gave Brenda a rifle for Christmas, a weapon she would later use in ways that were beyond comprehension. In the days leading up to the shooting, Brenda's behavior took a darker turn. She made a chilling statement to her classmates, promising to do something big so she could get on TV. It was a statement that would haunt those who heard it, as they would soon realize that it was not just the ramblings of a troubled teenager, but the prelude to a tragedy. The morning of January 29, 1979, began like any other school day at San Diego's Cleveland Elementary School. Children laughed and played on the school playground, oblivious to the horror that was about to unfold. Across the street, Brenda and Spencer stood in their house, peering through the scope of the .22 caliber rifle their father had given them. As school principal Burton Ragaba opened the doors, Brenda grabbed the .22 caliber semi-automatic rifle, a Christmas gift from her father, and positioned herself by the window. What followed was a scene of chaos and utter horror as she opened fire on the innocent children. School principal Borden Ragg ran to protect the children but was shot and killed on the pavement. Janitor Mike Schar heroically tried to pull Bragg to safety but was also fatally wounded. The rampage continued and 8 children and 1 police officer were injured before Brenda stopped shooting. The police response was swift. Law enforcement officers were called to the scene and, using their training, went to work securing the area and assisting the victims. Emergency services rushed to the school with sirens blaring while paramedics treated the wounded and transported them to hospitals. In the meantime, a police officer contacted Brenda by phone, setting off a tense negotiation. The question on everyone's mind was, why? When asked by a reporter why, Brenda's chilling response was, "I don't like Mondays. It brightens my day." This callous comment would become a haunting refrain associated with the senseless violence of that day. In the aftermath of the shooting, questions were raised as to what could drive a 16-year-old girl to commit such a heinous act. The investigation into Brenda Spencer's motives became the focus of law enforcement and a horrified public searching for answers. Detectives delved into Brenda's past, uncovering a history of run-ins with the law and a home life plagued by neglect and possible abuse. The investigation revealed that Brenda had been arrested not only for the BB gun incident at the same school, which she would later attack with deadly intent, but also for burglary. Despite these red flags, she had been placed on probation, a decision that now seemed tragically misguided. When Brenda was taken into custody, her mental state became the subject of intense scrutiny. Her probation officer's earlier recommendation for psychiatric treatment, which had been ignored by her father, resurfaced as a critical piece of the puzzle. Her defense attorneys considered pleading insanity but ultimately did not. The trial proceeded, and despite her youth, Brenda was charged as an adult due to the seriousness of her crimes. The severity of the situation was exacerbated by the fact that she was facing charges that carried a life sentence. In a decision that surprised many, Brenda pleaded guilty to 2 counts of murder and assault with a deadly weapon. In 1980, Brenda and Spencer was sentenced to concurrent terms of 25 years to life. All 9 counts of attempted murder against her were dismissed, but the weight of the sentence reflected the seriousness of her actions. During her trial and subsequent hearings, Brenda's attorneys argued that the treatment she received from her father, including alleged sexual abuse, was a significant factor in her violent outburst. However, this argument had little bearing on the opinion of the parole board or the public. The image of a young woman with a rifle pointed at innocent children was indelibly etched into the collective consciousness, a stark reminder of the potential for darkness that lies within Austin Myers. In the heart of America, a teenager went from being a simple school friend to a cold-blooded killer. Austin Myers, a teenager with a troubled past, was about to cross a line from which there was no return. His former high school friend, Kate Spack, a recent graduate of Waynesville High School, was completely unaware of the dark clouds looming over his future. BC, full of patriotic fervor, prepared to embark on a new chapter in his life, eager to serve his country in the Navy. But fate had a different plan, written in the hands of someone he once called a friend. The choice fell on Mark Cates, Bach's stepfather, who was known to have a safe at his home that was rumored to contain a small fortune. Myers and his accomplice Mosley had initially planned to rob the safe, but upon realizing that B was home, they retreated only to hatch a more heinous plot. Myers, who had attended the same high school as Bach and had been his friend in 7th and 8th grade, knew about the safe and believed it contained $1,000. In a chilling conversation, Myers proposed the idea that would seal their fates. Why not remove the obstacles standing in their way? Myers suggested that they could strangle Bach with a cable, making it appear that he had stolen the safe and fled. They purchased a 3-foot length of steel cable and 2 metal staples. The components of a garrote, a tool of death that would transform them from burglars to murderers. On the morning of January 28, 2014, Myers and Mosley purchased septic enzymes, ammonia, septic tank cleaner, and rubber gloves. They arrived at Bach's residence around 1 p.m. under the pretense of a casual visit. BCK welcomed them into his home unaware of the betrayal that awaited him. When B turned his back and headed toward the kitchen, Mosley saw his opportunity. He attacked, attempting to strangle B with the garrote while Myers assisted him by holding B in front. The struggle became fierce and all three men fell to the kitchen floor. In a panic, Mosley pulled out his knife and repeatedly stabbed B. Myers then took over by placing the garrote around Bach's neck, while Mosley continued the assault, stabbing Bach in the chest a total of 21 times. Following Bach's death, Myers and Mosley searched for the safe and found it in a closet. However, it was locked. They ransacked the house, taking the safe, some jewelry, and credit cards. They then wrapped Bach's body in a blanket and placed it in the trunk of Mosley's car. They attempted to clean the crime scene with ammonia and left the house around 2 p.m. as he drove. Mosley became paranoid that he was being followed, so he took back roads to a remote area where he parked and checked the outside of his car for blood. They decided to hide the body behind a log in a field near the town of Gratis in Pebble County. Myers poured ammonia and septic tanks over the body and fired 2 shots into Bach's body. The gun jammed on the 3rd shot. Myers cleared the jam, ejecting the bullet onto the ground, where police later found it. After hiding the body, Myers suggested that they kill Cates to make it look like he had killed Bach and disappeared. They decided against it and headed to a park in Brookville, where Mosley threw the laptop in a dumpster. They purchased a crowbar in Englewood and returned to Mosley's home to open the safe. Instead of the $1,000 Myers had promised, the safe contained some papers, loose change, bullets, gun accessories, and other random items. Following the brutal murder of Justin Bach, an investigation began that would uncover a web of deception and cold-blooded schemes. The case took a turn when Cates Bach arrived home to find her home burglarized and her son missing. The discovery of a distinctive car previously seen at the Bach residence became a key lead. The vehicle, which was missing its back window and was wrapped in plastic and red duct tape, belonged to Austin Myers, who had been at the Bach home just the day before. Warren County Sheriff's detectives were relentless in their efforts and eventually located the suspect car and arrested Myers at a friend's house. Myers, initially feigning ignorance, was brought in for questioning. His story began to unravel as detectives pieced together the evidence. Interrogation revealed a sinister plot and Myers admitted to being present during the murder, although he initially denied any direct involvement. The walls closed in on Myers when his accomplice, Timothy Mosley, heard Myers' version of events and decided to confess, implicating Myers in the process. Myers' story changed under the weight of the new evidence and he confessed to his role in the grisly act, including purchasing the materials used in the murder. The discovery of Justin Bach's body, as directed by Myers, confirmed Myers' worst fears. An autopsy performed by the Montgomery County coroner concluded that Bach had suffered multiple stab wounds. The case took on new dimensions when public opinion was confronted with the fact that Mosley, the knife wielder, would escape the death penalty in a plea deal while Myers, the mastermind behind the murder, would face the ultimate punishment. Austin Myers' trial and subsequent conviction became a national focus. At age 19, Myers was sentenced to death on October 17, 2014, becoming the youngest inmate ever to be sentenced to death row in Ohio. Justin Bock's murder not only led to a call for harsher murder sentences in Ohio, known as Justin's Law, but also highlighted disparities in the justice system. Myers now awaits execution at Chillicothe Correctional Facility, while Mosley is serving a life sentence without parole at Ross Correctional Facility. Jennifer Lee. Jennifer Mee's trial was a spectacle that garnered national attention as the former internet celebrity grappled with the consequences of her actions. The courtroom became the scene of a battle between the prosecution's damning evidence and the defense's attempts to downplay my role in Shannon Griffin's murder. The prosecution relied on irrefutable evidence and witness testimony. Central to their case was a recording of a jailhouse phone call, a conversation between me and her mother that would prove pivotal. On the recording, my own words seemed to implicate her. "I didn't kill anyone. I set it all up. It all went wrong, Mom. It all went downhill after it all happened, Mom." This confession painted a picture of me as the mastermind behind the robbery that led to Griffin's death. How did it get here? In the dark corners of the internet, a teenage girl's life went from viral sensation to chilling headline that shocked the nation. Jennifer Mee, formerly known as the Epo Girl, found herself entangled in a deadly web of deceit and murder. Jennifer Mee's story begins in a modest neighborhood in St. Petersburg, Florida, where she was just another teenager until an unusual medical condition catapulted her to fleeting internet fame. Known nationwide as the Hiccup Girl, Mee suffered from relentless hiccups, suffering up to 50 hiccups per minute for weeks at a time. Her peculiar condition captured the hearts of Americans, prompting television appearances and sympathy from the public. But behind the hiccup and the cameras, Mee's life was far from the charming story it seemed. As the hiccups subsided, so did the spotlight, and Mee's life took on a darker turn. Struggling with the challenges of adolescence and the pressures of newfound fame, she began to associate with questionable people. During this dark period, Jennifer Mee's path crossed with Shannon Griffin, a 22-year-old Walmart worker with a friendly social media demeanor. The digital conversations between Mee and Griffin seemed innocent at first, but they were the precursor to a sinister plot. Mee and his roommates, Laron Rayford and Mont Newton, hatched a plan to rob Griffin. The trap was set, and the setting was an empty house in a quiet neighborhood. Unaware of the grim fate that awaited him, Griffin agreed to meet Mee in person, thinking it would be a chance encounter. On that fateful day, as the Florida sun sank below the horizon, Shannon Griffin walked into a trap that would cost her life. Shannon Griffin arrived at the agreed-upon meeting point expecting to see Jennifer Mee, the girl she had been chatting with online. Instead, she found herself in the back of an empty house, a place that would soon become the scene of a crime. Mee, as bait, led Griffin around the property, where Laron Riff and Lamont Newton lay in wait, armed and dangerous with a .38 caliber pistol. The encounter quickly escalated as the robbery unfolded. Griffin, caught off guard, was shot four times in a brutal act that left him dead. Within hours of the crime, the St. Petersburg Police Department's swift response led to the arrest of Jennifer Mee and her accomplices. All three suspects, who shared a household, were taken into custody as the severity of their actions began to be understood. Sergeant Skinner of the St. Petersburg Police Department reported that Mee and her accomplices had admitted to their involvement in the crime, sealing their fate in the eyes of the law. Shannon Griffin's murder was not just a robbery gone wrong, it was a premeditated act that ended in cold-blooded murder. Forensic experts testified that DNA evidence linked them to the crime, as his genetic material was found on Griffin's shirt. This physical connection to the victim further strengthened the prosecution's case, leaving little doubt about his involvement. For the defense, attorney John Trevina faced the daunting task of humanizing Mee and presenting her in a light that would garner sympathy from the jury. The defense argued that Mee suffered from schizophrenia, a mental illness that may have affected her judgment and understanding of the situation. A psychological evaluation was ordered, but the results concluded that Mee was competent to stand trial, undermining the defense's case. Another unusual defense strategy involved M's infamous hiccups, which her attorney suggested were a symptom of Tourette syndrome. This was intended to introduce the idea that M's neurological disorder may have influenced her behavior, although it did little to address the direct evidence linking her to the crime. Despite the defense's best efforts to portray M.I. as a victim of her mental and neurological issues, the evidence against her was overwhelming. The jailhouse phone call, her DNA on the victim's shirt, and her confession to setting up the fatal encounter sealed her fate. M.I. wept in the Clearwater courtroom as the judge announced the verdict, as she had expected the judge to impose a lesser sentence. In 2013, M.I. was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without parole along with her accomplices Laron Rifford and Lamont Newton. Sierra Halsett and Aaron Guerrero. In Las Vegas, a tale of teenage romance turned into a nightmare that shook the community to its foundations. Sierra Halsett and Aaron Guerrero, two young lovers, found themselves at the center of a harrowing investigation that uncovered a plot so sinister it seemed unthinkable. The murder of Sierra's father, Daniel Halsett, and the couple's subsequent trial and conviction unfolded like a true crime drama, leaving the city in shock. Daniel's life was a tapestry of dedication to his family, his music, and his work in computer science, where he excelled as a consultant. But beneath the surface of this idyllic family portrait lurked currents of discord. After 11 years, Daniel and Elizabeth's marriage unraveled, marred by allegations of domestic abuse, leading to a bitter divorce and a custody battle that left scars too deep to heal. Daniel found solace in his children, especially his youngest, Sierra, when the dust settled. But as Sierra entered her teens, her heart was captivated by Aaron Guerrero, an 18-year-old with a rebellious streak as strong as her own. Their relationship, which began in June 1920, soon became a point of contention. Sensing trouble, Daniel forbade Sierra from seeing Aaron, unaware that this act would set in motion a chain of events with fatal consequences. Tensions reached a boiling point in the early hours of April 8, 2021. Sierra and Aaron, driven by a mix of youthful rebellion and dark intentions, embarked on a sinister shopping spree. They had been filmed purchasing the tools and accelerants they would use in the crime. In the days following the murder, they embarked on a spending spree, using Daniel Halsett's credit cards with reckless abandon, a trail of transactions that would help seal his fate. The details of the murder were gruesome. Daniel Halsett had been stabbed more than 70 times. His body was placed in a sleeping bag and attempts were made to dismember him with a chainsaw and circular saw before being set on fire. The discovery of her body in the garage of her home near Durango and Alta Roads was a grim reminder of the violence that had ensued. The investigation revealed that Daniel Halls had objected to his daughter's relationship with Guerrero, a factor that may have played a role in the events that unfolded. But it wasn't just the physical evidence that pointed the finger at Sierra and Aaron. A gruesome and shocking video surfaced. In it, the couple joked about the murder, a display of chilling nonchalance. Aaron Guerrero was heard saying, "Welcome back to our YouTube channel 3 days after murdering someone." To which Sierra Halls responded with a warning, "Oh, man, don't put that on camera." This video, a grotesque trophy of their actions, became key evidence, revealing their mindset and further implicating them in the crime. The couple, convicted of open murder and credit card fraud, faced the consequences of their actions in a courtroom where the gravity of their crime was palpable. Sierra Halsett gave a harrowing account as she read a letter in front of the judge detailing her allegations of sexual abuse and harassment at the hands of her father, whom she described as a drug addict and child molester. While these statements were shocking, they did not absolve her of responsibility for the brutal murder of Daniel Halsett. Aaron Guerrero, for his part, expressed remorse, apologizing to the victim's family and acknowledging that Daniel Halsett did not deserve to die in such a horrible way. His remorseful statement came after reaching a plea deal with prosecutors to avoid the death penalty, given that he was 18 at the time of the crime. The trial and sentencing of Sierra Halsett and Aaron Guerrero, the Las Vegas teens who committed a crime that shocked the city, resulted in them being sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 22 years. Click on a card above to see more content like this.